It's Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. Welcome to this hour of science fiction with some great stories coming up. Later on, two from Ray Bradbury on the CBS Radio Workshop. But right now, it's well-known science fiction author Poul Anderson's only contribution to the X-1 series, his story called The Light. This from October 24th, 1957 on NBC.
This is Nightline, your open door to people and places, and this is Walter O'Keefe. Nightline invites you to listen in on NBC's award-winning science fiction series, X-1.
Countdown for blast-off. X-5... 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire.
From the far horizon of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents X-1. Tonight, The Light by Poul Anderson. But first, hear this. The glamour backstage at Broadway's newest hit musical show, the spectacular West Side Story, the novel experience of accompanying a congressman, Joseph Martin, as he searches out the complaints, compliments, and problems of his constituents on a grassroots tour of his district, the thrill of attending one of the top football games in the nation as Army versus Virginia, the excitement of spending late evening hours with the music of top artists performing in famous nightclubs in New York and Chicago. These are just a few of the highlights of the weekend entertainment Monitor has planned for you. Beginning tomorrow night, Gene Kelly, Milton Berle, Tab Hunter, and Tony Martin are among the celebrities who will be visiting you over the Monitor weekend. There'll be comedy by Fibber McGee and Molly and Bob and Ray, music, news, and sports, all on Monitor. So why don't you start your weekend right with Monitor on Friday night and stay with Monitor all weekend long over most of these same NBC radio stations. Now, X-1, and tonight's story, The Light.
You really should feel highly honored, Professor. You're the only person I've been allowed to tell this to. And, of course, there's a good reason why you're being permitted to hear it. Why? I think you'll see why before I've finished. We're not a gang of power-nutty militarists, you know that. Personally, I'd like to tell it to the whole world, but it could very well touch off a war, and a war would mean the absolute end of civilization. There's one thing you should understand right from the start. Just because I know enough math and physics, just because I could pass the most rigid physical exam ever devised, doesn't mean I don't know anything about culture and art. When they picked me for the three-man crew for the first landing on the moon, they were a little condescending about that side of my background. Baird, the skipper, and Hernandez, the engineer, the other two members of my team, were a little leery of me just because I could talk about art every now and then. They needn't have worried. Once we left the space station and got into orbit, we didn't have much to do for several days but talk.
Look at it. From this distance, you'd swear the Earth was uninhabited.
It's hanging like a big sapphire in the inky black.
Poetry. Don't you ever quit spouting it.
Why are you writing me all the time, Baird?
Maybe I don't trust a scientist who keeps talking about art all the time.
You think there's no connection between the two?
I know blamed well there isn't.
I always thought that when you got up this high, you could make out the continents. I can't tell where the sea ends and the land begins.
It's the clouds lying all over the surface that make it so tough. I think that's Russia coming into view, isn't it, Skipper?
According to the orbital schedule, that should be Siberia emerging from the Terminator right about now.
Are they watching us, I wonder?
Why not? They've got a space station of their own with good telescopes on it.
Yeah, and I'll bet they're hoping that we smack into a meteor.
Maybe they don't have to hope. Maybe they've already arranged an accident.
I doubt it, Baird. They wouldn't risk sabotaging us. Not on a trip like this with the whole world watching.
Because it might start a war? Don't make me laugh. Nobody's going to start shooting when they know the whole world will go up in smoke just to avenge 3 spacemen and a $10 million hunk of ship.
Ever hear of chain reaction? One sharp diplomatic note might set off the whole thing. You think our own government would be sending us to the moon if there were any military advantage to be gained from it?
Then what's the idea? Why are we doing this?
Prestige. Yeah. They put up the first satellite, built the first space station. Now we've got to be the first man to step on the moon, or the rest of the world will start looking on us as a second-rate power.
You make it sound like some kind of game.
Oh, it is, Hernandez. The deadliest game mankind ever played. One false move and bang, the whole world goes up in a mushroom cloud.
How long will it go on? That's what gets me.
As long as there's a balance of power. But let one side, Russia or us, find a really new concept. Something the other side doesn't even dream about. And it'll be all over.
Suppose they find it before we do.
That'll be too bad for us. The Cold War will be over, and so will we.
Why don't you shut up, the two of you? You both talk too much.
It was the wrong thing to say, I knew, out there in the great quiet night. We shouldn't carry our little hates and fears and greeds out beyond the sky and into space. Or perhaps the fact that we can be burdened with them and still reach the moon shows that man is bigger than he knows. I couldn't say. Anyhow, as the whole world knows, we made it. Our landing site hadn't been chosen exactly, but as you know, Professor, we came down at the foot of the lunar Alps, not far from the crater Plato. We felt no sense of pioneering when we touched down. We were tired and tense. It was merely a hard, breakneck job.
Hot rockets.
Rockets off.
Well, gentlemen, we're on the moon.
Can we open the viewports? I want to see this.
Go ahead. I'm bushed. Look at that.
That light. I didn't realize it would be so bright.
It's a cold, eerie light. It's not like our deserts on Earth. They aren't as bright or as dead.
All right, that's enough gawking. Our orders are to draw lots to see who's first on the moon. All right, Hernandez, you draw first.
Well, Professor, we drew lots. And, of course, everyone knows who won. I did. I was to be the first man ever to set foot on the moon. At least for a little while, that's what I believed.
You're listening to The Light, tonight's attraction on X-1. Now, back to X-1 and The Light.
We were in heavy space suits, of course, and it wasn't any too easy to move about, even with the light gravity of the moon. I stepped out of the airlock first, followed by Baird. I just stood there in the shadow of the ship, looking at the weird light, lost in wonder. I don't know how long I stood there before Baird spoke to me.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead what?
Make the speech. You're the first man on the moon.
You mean that prepared speech they gave us? No, thanks.
We've got to make it. What's the matter with you?
It's your job to make the speeches.
This is mutiny, you know. I ordered you to make it.
I could make a suggestion. Why don't you write in the log that the speech was made and let it go at that?
Judas Priest, man. All right. But if this ever gets out...
It's our secret, Captain. Consider the speech made. Well, what do we do now?
You start gathering rock samples. I'm going to take pictures. Come on the double.
So we went to work. I gathered some samples, and each time I did, I left a little mark in the dust on the surface. The traces I left would probably last until the sun burned out. It seemed like an act of desecration, though the landscape was ugly enough. No. No, that's not true. It wasn't ugly. Only alien. You know, it was several hours before I could really begin to see anything. I mean, it took that long for my brain to start registering in this strange, eerie place. I remember pausing to rest a minute while I watched Baird making adjustments on his camera lens and snapping various bits of landscape.
Yeah, that ought to be a good one.
You know, Baird, the thing that gets me is the light.
It's no trouble. I'm using an F8 exposure this time.
I mean the quality of it. It isn't like anything I ever saw on Earth. I wonder if it can be photographed.
Of course it'll photograph.
You know, in a way, it reminds me of that weird brass-colored light you get just before a storm on Earth. That it isn't the same either.
No, I think I'll try an F11 setting.
What I mean, though, Baird, is I don't think you can get the feel of this light in a picture. What you'd need for that is such a painter as hasn't lived for centuries. Rembrandt? No, it's too harsh a light for him. Cold light that's somehow hell hot.
Will you shut up, you and your blasted Renaissance?
Well, I suppose Baird had a point. This was hardly the place for a chat about art. We went back to the ship after that, had a meal and a nap before setting out for more explorations. We decided to take a look at the Plato crater, and conditions were right for it, so we set off, all three of us this time. I won't describe the walk in detail. I can't. It wasn't simply the landscape and the lighting. On the moon, your weight is only 1/6 as much as it is on Earth, while the inertia remains the same. It feels almost like walking underwater. But you can move very fast once you get the hang of it. After a while, we reached the crater wall, climbed it, and stood looking down. Then Hernandez saw something and let out a yelp that almost split my ear when I heard it on the speaker in my helmet.
Hey, look!
What's the matter? What happened?
There, in the floor of the crater, that mist.
Yes, I see.
Then they were right.
Who? What are you talking about?
The astronomers. They thought they saw something that looked like a mist in some of the big craters. They're right. It's right in front of our eyes.
I thought there was no atmosphere here. How could there be mist?
Maybe there's some kind of water table down on the floor of the crater.
Hey, get back here.
I want to go down for a closer look, Baird.
And break your leg so we have to carry you home? No dice. You stay here.
Well, we've got to find out.
He couldn't break anything wearing that space suit. They're like armor.
Stay here. I'll have your court-martial.
Oh, Skipper, have a heart.
Yeah, come on, Skipper. We've got to find out what that stuff is.
In the end, we convinced Captain Baird. But he insisted we rope ourselves together before we made the descent. It was agonizing work getting down the lip of that crater, but we made it. We stood there silently on the floor of the crater, bathed in a cold, golden-white radiance. There's never been such a light on Earth. It seemed to pervade everything, drenching us cold and white, like silence made luminous. It was the light of Nirvana. And somewhere, somehow, I had seen it before. I stood there unable to speak until another yell from Hernandez brought me to my senses with a wrench.
Oh, no. Oh, no. It can't be.
Now, what's the matter, Hernandez?
Look there in the dust of the crater. Look and tell me I'm crazy.
Good Lord. Footprints. Footprints of a man. Who?
There's only one other country on Earth that could send a spaceship to the moon yet.
Yes, Hernandez. Russians. Are they still here, I wonder?
We can't tell by staring at the tracks. They could be 5 hours old or 5 million years.
But why haven't they told the world? Why haven't they been bragging about it?
Why do you think?
You mean they've found something of vital military importance?
Look up at the Earth. Maybe right now they're planning their next move. The last move.
I don't believe it. They couldn't have done it. They couldn't have kept it secret.
Why not? They could have taken off in a black ship when our space station was on the opposite side of the planet. How would we know? Come on.
Where?
Back to the ship, of course. They'll have to know about this in Washington immediately.
If they find out we know their secret, that could be enough, Baird. That could trigger the war.
I've got a code.
Are you sure it can't be broken? That it already hasn't been broken?
Shut up, you troublemaking whelp. Let me alone.
Just the same, Skipper. We better follow those tracks. See where they lead to.
We didn't bring any weapons. I'd be surprised if they were as careless.
Baird, listen to me. All right,
me later if you want, but listen. We can't just go back to the ship, never knowing for sure what these footprints are and who left them.
How much looking can you do? In less than 1 hour, the sun will sink behind the lip of the crater. When that happens, it's going to get cold. Colder than anything you've ever imagined.
I've got a heating unit in my suit.
Good for 20 minutes at the most against a cold like that. Barely time to get back to the ship.
All right. I'll take the chance and get back in time. But let me follow those footprints, Baird.
It's your duty to let them, Baird.
All right, permission granted. God help you.
Baird and Hernandez, still roped together, climbed the crater side and disappeared, leaving me alone, staring at the hobnail boot footprints of a man. I had to work fast, knowing that the sun would soon disappear and the awful cold begin. I went on, following the steps in the still, lifeless dust of the moon. At last, I came to the place I was looking for. It wasn't much to see. There was a long track of plowed dust and a chipped stone where something had landed and taken off again. And this was the astonishing thing. There was no sign of a rocket blast. A few scars where a pick had removed samples, footprints, and that's all. Someone, sometime, had landed here without rockets and had never told anyone about it. I looked up at the sky, saw the ruddy speck of Mars, and felt cold. Had the Martians beaten us to our own moon? But I had to get back now. Every second longer that I remained whittled down my chances of ever reaching the ship again. I was about to start back when something caught my eye. A big chunk of rock with something carved on it. Something unmistakable. A cross. A million suns wheeled and glittered above me. Then I knew. I remembered where I had seen that weird light which remained on the wall at sundown. And then I knew the truth. I turned and started to run for the ship. I almost didn't make it. Baird met me halfway, ripped off my pack, and connected another heating unit.
Jackass! Puddin' brain fool! I'm going to have you up before a court-martial, so help me if it's the last thing I...
Even if I tell you who made those footprints in Plato?
What?
I can, you know. I've got it all figured out. And in a way, it's a good joke on you.
All right, back into the ship with you, and let's hear the whole story. And it better be good.
Of course, intelligence has been working night and day ever since we returned and made our report. They know we were telling the truth. And that's why you've been drafted, Professor. We're going overseas together, you and I. Officially, we're tourists. You search the archives, and I'll tell you when you've turned up something we can use. Oh, we'll find it. We'll find something. It couldn't have been done by rockets, you see. Even if the physics had been known, which it wasn't, the chemistry and metallurgy wasn't there. But there was something else. Anti-gravity? Maybe. Whatever it is, when we find it, the Cold War will be over and we'll have won. You don't get it? Professor, I'm shocked and grieved. You're a historian, a cultured man. All right, then. Our first stop is the National Gallery in London, where there's a painting called The Virgin of the Rocks. In that painting, you'll see a light, cold and pale and utterly gentle. A light which never shone on Earth. A light playing over the mother and child. And the artist, Professor, but of course you know the answer now. The artist was Leonardo da Vinci.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features the conclusion of an exciting two-part serial, Wolfbane, by Frederick Pohl and C.M. Kornbluth. Read it in Galaxy Magazine on your newsstand today. X-1 has brought you The Light, a story written by Paul Anderson and adapted for radio by William Welch. Featured in our cast were Carl Weber as the narrator, David Kerman as Captain Baird, and Bob Hastings as Hernandez. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was an NBC Radio Network production.
X-1 on Tuned to Yesterday from October 24th, 1957, an NBC Radio broadcast. You're listening to an hour of sci-fi on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. And now, two stories from Ray Bradbury on the CBS Radio Workshop. Season of Disbelief is the first, marking chapters 15 and 16 in his 1957 published novel, Dandelion Wine. For the fourth broadcast of this radio series from February 17th, 1956 on CBS, we hear actors Virginia Gregg, Paula Winslow, Roy Glenn, and Vivi Janis and Larry Dobkin both playing two parts.
CBS Radio, a division of the Columbia Broadcasting System and its 217 affiliated stations, present the CBS Radio Workshop, radio's distinguished series dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, from Hollywood, Season of Disbelief and Hail and Farewell, adapted and directed by Anthony Ellis. Two unusual and provocative character studies by one of America's most original authors, Ray Bradbury. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bradbury.
It has always seemed to me that life, to all of us, is an endless coil of rope playing through our hands every moment of every hour of the day. The long line of the rope goes back to the time we were born and extends on out ahead to the time of our death. In between lies the eternal now, the flickering moments when each of us must play the rope as best we can, without burning our fingers, snarling the coils, or breaking the line. This is a study of one woman and her rope.
Season of Disbelief. Old Mrs. Bentley was a saver. She saved tickets, old theater programs, bits of lace, scarves, railroad transfers and such things. All the tags and tokens of her experience she saved.
I have a stack of records. Here's Caruso. It was in 1921 in New York. I was 40. John was still alive. Here's June Moon, 1929, I think, right after John died.
That was the huge regret of her life, in a way. The one thing she had most enjoyed touching and listening to and looking at, she hadn't saved. John was far out in the meadow country, dated and boxed and hidden under grasses. And nothing remained of him but his high silk hat, his cane, and his good suit in the closet. But what she could keep, she had kept. Pink flower dresses crushed among mothballs and vast black trunks, and cut glass dishes from her childhood. Her past lived with her. Then, the thing with the children. It happened in the middle of the summer. Mrs. Bentley, coming out to water the ivy on her front porch, saw the two cool-colored, sprawling girls lying on her green lawn, enjoying the immense prickling of the grass. At the very moment she was smiling down on them with her yellow mask face, around a corner, like an elfin band, came an ice cream wagon. The two girls sat up, turning their heads like sunflowers after the sun.
Little girls, would you like some?
The wagon stopped. There was an exchange of money for pieces of the original ice age. These she gave to the girls, who thanked her with snow in their mouths, their eyes darting from her buttoned-up shoes to her white hair.
Don't you want a bite?
No, no, child. I'm old enough and cold enough. Hottest day won't thaw me. Come up on the porch and sit in the shade. But mind you don't drip.
I'm Alice. She's Jane.
How nice. I'm Mrs. Bentley. They call me Helen.
I didn't know old ladies had first names.
Well, you never hear them used.
Oh, my dear, when you're as old as I, they won't call you Jane either. Old age is dreadfully formal.
How old are you?
I remember the dinosaur.
No, but how old?
75.
That's old.
I don't feel any different now than when I was your age.
Our age?
Yes, once I was a pretty little girl, just like you, Jane. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Oh, you don't have to go so soon, I hope.
Well?
Is something the matter? What?
My mother says it isn't nice to fib.
Of course it isn't.
And not to listen to fibs.
Who was fibbing to you, Alice?
You were.
About what?
About your age. About being a little girl.
But I was. Many years ago, a little girl like you.
Come on, Jane.
But how ridiculous. It's perfectly obvious. Everyone was young once.
You're joking with us. You weren't really 10 ever, were you, Mrs. Bentley?
You run on home. Get away from here. I won't have you laughing.
And your name's not really Helen.
Of course it's Helen.
Goodbye.
Thanks for the ice cream.
Once I played hopscotch. You hear me? I did. The idea. No one ever doubted I was a girl before. What a silly, horrible thing to do. I don't mind being old. Not really. But I do resent having my childhood taken away from me.
After supper, she gathered together certain items in a perfumed kerchief. Then she went to her front porch and stood there stiffly for half an hour. As suddenly as night birds, the two girls flew by, and Mrs. Bentley's voice brought them to a fluttering rest.
Girls! Girls!
Yes, Mrs. Bentley?
Come up out of the porch.
Yes, Mrs. Bentley.
I've got some treasures to show you. Sit down, both of you. Now, here. I wore this when I was 9.
It's a comb.
Let's see. It's pretty.
And here's a tiny ring I wore when I was 8. It doesn't fit my finger now.
Why, it just fits me.
The comb fits my head.
And here, a picture.
Who's this little girl?
It's me.
Oh, it doesn't look like you.
Anybody could get a picture like this somewhere.
But it's the truth.
Any more pictures, Mrs. Bentley? Of you later? You got a picture of you at 15? And one at 20? Oh. One at 40? 50?
Oh, nonsense. I don't have to show you anything.
And we don't have to believe you.
But this picture proves I was young.
That's some other little girl like us. You borrowed it.
I was married.
Where's Mr. Bentley?
He's been gone a long time. If he were here, he'd tell you how young and pretty I was when I was 22.
But he's not here, and he can't tell.
I have a marriage certificate.
You could have borrowed it.
The only way I'll believe you were ever young is if you have someone say they saw you when you were 10.
Thousands of people saw me, but they're dead, you little fool. Dead or ill or gone away in other towns. I don't know a soul here. Just moved here a few years ago, so no one saw me young.
Well, there you are. Nobody saw her.
Listen, you must take these things on faith. Someday you'll be as old as I. People will say the same. Oh, no. They'll say those vultures were never hummingbirds. Those owls were never orioles. Those parrots were never bluebirds. One day you'll be like me.
No, I won't.
Or me.
No, you wait and see. You, child, your mother. Haven't you noticed over the years the change?
No, she's always the same.
I guess we'd better go home. Thanks for the comb, it's fine.
And thanks for the ring. It just fits. And the picture of the little girl.
No, come back. You can't have those. They're mine.
No, you stole them. They belong to some little girl. You stole them.
No! Come back! Oh, come back!
She lay awake for many hours into that night, among her trunks and trinkets. A night wind blew in the room. The white curtain fluttered against a dark cane which had leaned against that wall near the other bric-a-brac for many years. The cane trembled and fell. Its gold ferrule glittered in the moonlight. It was her husband's opera cane. It seemed as if he were pointing it at her, as he often had, using his soft, sad, reasonable voice.
Those children are right. They stole nothing from you, my dear. These things don't belong to you here, you, now. They belong to her, that other you, so long ago.
And then, as though an ancient phonograph record had been set hissing under a steel needle, she remembered a conversation she had once with Mr. Bentley. Mr. Bentley, so prim, a pink carnation in his whisk-broomed lapel.
My dear, you never will understand time, will you? Don't you see, no matter how hard you try to be what you once were, you can only be what you are here and now. Time plays tricks. When you're 9, you think you've always been 9 years old and will always be. When you're 30, it seems you've always been balanced there on that bright rim of middle life. And then, when you become 70, you are always and forever 70. You are in the present. You are trapped in a young now or an old now. But there is no other now to be seen. Ticket stubs are trickery. Saving things is a magic trick with mirrors. You're saving cocoons, corsets in a way you can never fit again. Why save them? You can't really prove you were ever young.
Pictures. Pictures, John.
No, they lie. You're not the picture.
After the
image. No, you're not the dates or the ink or the paper. You're not these trunks of junk and tricks. You're only here now, the present you.
Yes. I see. I see. In the morning, I'll do something final about this and settle down to being only me and nobody else for many other year. That's what I'll do.
Morning was bright and green, and there at her door, like moths bumping softly on the screen, were the two girls.
Got any more things to give us, Mrs. Bentley? More of the little girls' things?
She led them down the hall to the library.
Take this.
The dress in which she had played the mandarin's daughter at 15.
And this.
A kaleidoscope, a magnifying glass.
Pick out anything you want. Books, skates, dolls, everything. They're yours.
Ours?
Only yours. And will you help me with a little work? I'm building a big fire in my backyard. I'm emptying the trunks, throwing out this trash for the trash man. It doesn't belong to me. Nothing ever belongs to anybody.
We'll help you, Mrs. Bentley. It'll be fun.
And now, on summer afternoons, you can see the two little girls like wrens on a wire on Mrs. Bentley's front porch. They sit in their cool dresses, not stirring, waiting for her. And when the silvery chimes of the ice cream man are heard, the front door opens, Mrs. Bentley floats out with her hand deep in the throat of her silver-mouthed purse, and for half an hour you can see them there on the porch, the two girls and the old lady, putting coldness into warmness, eating chocolate icicles, laughing. At last, they are good friends.
How old are you, Mrs. Bentley?
75.
How old were you 50 years ago?
75.
You were never young, were you? And never wore ribbons or dresses like these?
No, Jane. Never.
Have you got a first name?
My name is Mrs. Bentley.
And you've always lived in this one house?
Always.
And never were pretty?
Never.
Never in a million trillion years.
Never in a million trillion years.
Presenting now the second of our duo, and Mr. Ray Bradbury.
The rope of life hisses through our fingers. We reach, it's gone. The beauty of any particular flower, song, poem, or person lies often in the fact that roses must fade, songs die with the breath, poems burn in the fire. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. But what if beauty could be made to last? Would it still be beautiful or monstrous? Here's the study of a person who seized the traveling rope of life, a moment of beauty, and felt it freeze in his hands.
Hail and farewell.
Going away. There was nothing else to do. The time was up, the clock had run out, and he was going very far away indeed. His suitcase was packed, shoes shined, hair brushed, it expressly washed behind his ears, and it remained only for him to go down the stairs, out the front door, and up the street to the small town station where the train would make a stop for him alone. Then Fox Hill, Illinois, would be left far off in his past. And he would go on, perhaps to Iowa, perhaps to Kansas, perhaps even to California.
Willie?
Yes?
Almost time.
All right. I'll be down.
In the mirror on his dresser, he saw a face made of June dandelions and July apples and warm summer morning milk. There, as always, was his look of the angel and the innocent, which might never in the years of his life change. Picked up his valise, looked once more around his room, and went downstairs.
Here I am.
You can't really be leaving us, Willie.
People are beginning to talk. I've been here 3 years now, but when people begin to talk, I know it's time to put on my shoes and buy a railroad ticket.
It's all so strange. I just don't understand. It's so sudden. We'll miss you, Willie. We'll miss you very much.
I'll write you every Christmas.
It's been a great pleasure and satisfaction. It's a shame it had to stop. Shame that you had to tell us about yourself. An awful shame you can't stay on.
You're the nicest folks I ever had.
Oh, Willie. Willie.
It's not easy to go. You get used to things. You want to stay. But it doesn't work. I tried to stay on once after people began to suspect. How horrible, people said. All these years playing with our innocent children, they said. And us not guessing. Awful. And I finally had to leave town one night. It's not easy. You know darn well how much I love both of you. Thanks for 3 swell years. Well...
Willie, where will you go?
I don't know. I just start traveling. When I see a town that looks nice and green, I settle in.
Will you ever come back?
Oh, in about 20 years, maybe it should begin to show on my face. When it does, I'm going to make a grand tour of all the mothers and fathers I've had.
Oh, Willie.
We can't complain, Anna. Better to have had a son... 36 months than none whatever.
Well, I guess it's time. Goodbye. Thanks.
Willie kissed Anna quickly, touched Steve's hand, seized his luggage, and was gone up the street in the green noon light under the trees, not looking back. A small boy, 12 years old, with a birth certificate in his valise to show that he had been born 43 years ago. The boys were playing on the Green Park Diamond when he came by. He stood a little while among the oak tree shadows, watching them hurl the white, snowy baseball into the warm summer air. The boys' voices yelled, and the ball lit on the path near Willie.
Hey, Willie!
Where are you going, Willie?
Gonna visit a cousin of mine for a few days.
Huh?
You guys just throwing the ball around, huh?
Yeah. You taking the train alone, Willie?
Yeah.
Boy, that's neat.
Hey, how about a couple of throws? I got a little time.
Sure, I guess so.
Willie dropped his bag and ran back. The white baseball was already up in the sun and plunging down to him. And away again to their white figures, up in the sun again, rushing, life coming and going in a pattern. He thought of the last 3 years, now spent to the penny, and the 5 years before that, and so on down the line. The baseball flying here, there. Mr. and Mrs. Robert Hanlon, Creek Bend, Wisconsin, 1932, the first couple, the first year. Henry and Alice Bolts, Limeville, Iowa, 1935. The Smiths, the Eatons, Robinsons, 1939, 1945. Husband and wife, husband and wife. No children, no children, no children. A knock on this door, a knock on that.
Pardon me. My name is William. I wonder if I could...
A sandwich? Come in. Come in and sit down. Where are you from, son?
The sandwich, tall glass of cold milk, the smiling, the nodding, the comfortable, leisurely talking.
Son, you look like you've been traveling. You run off from somewhere.
No.
Are you an orphan?
We always wanted kids. Never worked out. Never knew why, one of those things. Well, getting late, son. Don't you think you better hit for home?
I got no home.
A boy like you? Not dry behind the ears? Your mother'll get worried.
I got no home and no folks anywhere in the world. I wonder... Could I sleep here tonight?
Well, now. Well, son, I don't just know. We never considered taking in a...
We've got chicken for supper tonight. Enough for extras. Enough for company.
The voices and the faces and the people and always the same first conversations. The years turning, flying away. The voice of Emily Robinson in a rocking chair in summer night darkness. The last night he stayed with her. The night she discovered his secret. Her voice saying,
I look at all the little children's faces going by, and I sometimes think, what a shame. What a shame that all these flowers have to be cut. All these bright fires have to be put out. What a shame all these have to get tall and unsightly and wrinkle and turn gray or get bald and finally all bone and wheeze be dead and buried off away. When I hear them laugh, I can't believe they'll ever go the road I'm going. They're so eager for everything. I guess that's what I miss most in older folks. The eagerness gone, 9 times out of 10. The freshness gone. So much of the drive and life down the drain. I like to watch school let out each day. It's like someone threw a bunch of flowers out of the school front doors. How does it feel, Willie? How does it feel to be young forever? Are you happy? Are you as fine as you seem?
I worked with what I had. After my folks died, after I found I couldn't get man's work anywhere, I tried carnivals, but they only laughed. Son, they said, you're not a midget. And even if you are, you look like a boy. We want midgets with midgets' faces. Sorry, son. What was I? A boy? I looked like a boy, sounded like a boy. So I might as well go on being a boy. What could I do? What job was there for me? And then one day I saw this man in a restaurant looking at another man's pictures of his kids. Sure wish I had kids, he said. Sure wish I had kids. And that instant, sitting there, I knew what my job would be for all the rest of my life. There was work for me. Making lonely people happy. Keeping myself busy. Playing forever. I knew I had to play forever. Deliver a few papers, run a few errands, mow a few lawns. All I had to do was to be a mother's son and a father's pride.
But, Willie, didn't you ever get lonely? Didn't you want things that grown-ups wanted?
I fought that out alone. I'm a boy, I told myself. I'll have to live in a boy's world, read boys' books, play boys' games, cut myself off from everything else. And I played it that way. Oh, it wasn't easy. There were times.
But it's nice being a child for over 40 years.
It's a living, as they say. And when you make other people happy, then you're almost happy, too. And anyway, in a few years now, I'll be in my second childhood. All the fevers will be out of me and all the unfulfilled things. And most of the dreams. Then I can relax.
He threw the baseball one last time and broke the reverie. Then he was picking up his suitcase. The two boys stood beside him. They were embarrassed at his shaking hands with him.
Oh, Willie, means if you're going to China or something.
Oh, that's right. It isn't.
So long, Willie. See you next week.
Yeah. So long, Sam. So long, Jim.
And he was walking off with his suitcase again, looking at the trees, going away from the boys and the street where he had lived. And as he turned the corner, a train whistle screamed and he began to run. In the early morning, with the iron smell of the train around him and a full night of traveling shaking his bones and his body, he awoke and looked out on a small town just arising from sleep. A porter moved by, a shadow in the shadows.
Sir, what town's this?
Valleyville.
How many people?
10,000. Why, this your stop?
It looks green. It looks nice and quiet.
Son, you know where you're going?
Here.
I hope you know what you're doing, boy.
Yes, sir. I know what I'm doing.
He was down the dark aisle, luggage lifted after him by the porter, and out into this smoking, steaming, cold, beginning to lighten morning. He stood looking at the porter in the black metal train against the few remaining stars.
Board!
Wish me luck!
What?
Wish me luck!
Oh, best of luck, son. Best of luck to you, boy.
Thanks.
He watched the black train. He didn't move all the time it was going. He stood quietly, a small boy, 12 years old again, on the worn wooden platform, and only after 3 entire minutes until the train was completely gone away and out of sight did he turn at last to face the empty streets below. Then, as the sun was rising, he began to walk very fast so as to keep warm down into the new town.
Tonight, the CBS Radio Workshop has presented two studies by Ray Bradbury, adapted and directed by Anthony Ellis. The first, Season of Disbelief, with Virginia Gregg and John Daner, Dawn Bender, Marion Richmond, and Herb Butterfield. The second, Hail and Farewell, with Richard Beals, Stacey Harris, Vivi Janis, Lawrence Dopkin, Paula Winslow, Roy Glenn, Billy Chapin, and Peggy Weber. We wish to thank Mr. Bradbury for being our special guest. Original music for tonight's program was composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith. The CBS Radio Workshop is produced by William Frug. This is Hugh Douglas inviting you to join us again next week when we present the eminent Shakespearean teacher, Dr. Frank C. Baxter, professor of English at the University of Southern California, and Mr. William Shakespeare, noted author, who will be our special guests, presented on the CBS Radio Workshop. On Sunday, over most of these same stations, the New York Philharmonic Symphony will be heard in another exciting concert conducted by Dmitri Metropolis. This weekend, the noted Polish pianist, Witold Malkuczynski, will be heard as soloist. Stay tuned for 5 minutes of CBS News, to be followed on most of these stations by The Jack Carson Show. America listens most to the CBS Radio Network.
The CBS Radio Workshop on Tuned to Yesterday from February 17, 1956 on CBS. That brings to a close this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVillier. Thanks for tuning in.